Altruism. Tor Nuritranders, science writer, consultant, lecturer, Copenhagen. Author, The Generous Man, How Helping Others is the Sexiest Thing You Can Do. The concept of altruism is ready for retirement. Not that the phenomenon of helping others and doing good to other people is about to go away, not at all. On the contrary, the appreciation of the importance of bonds between individuals is on the rise in the modern understanding of animal and human societies. What needs to go away is the basic idea behind the concept of altruism, that there is a conflict of interest between helping yourself and helping others. The word altruism was coined in the 1850s by the great French sociologist Auguste Comte. What it means is that you do something for other people, the old French altrui from the Latin alter, not just for yourself. Thus, it opposes egoism or selfishness. This concept is rooted in the notion that human beings and animals are dominated by selfishness and egoism, so that you need a concept to explain why they sometimes behave unselfishly and kindly to others. But the reality is different. Humans are deeply bound to other humans, and most actions are reciprocal and in the interest of both parties, or in the case of hatred, in the disinterest of both. The starting point is neither selfishness nor altruism, but the state of being bound together. It's an illusion to believe that you can be happy when no one else is, or that other people will not be affected by your unhappiness. Behavioral science and neurobiology have shown how intimately we're bound. Phenomena like mimicry, emotional contagion, empathy, sympathy, compassion, and pro-social behavior are evident in humans and animals alike. We're influenced by the well-being of others in more ways than we normally care to think of. Therefore, a simple rule applies. Everyone feels better when you're well, and you feel better when everyone is well. This correlated state is the real one. Egoism and its opposite concept, altruism, are second-order concepts, shadows, or even illusions. This applies also to the immediate psychological level. If helping others fills you with a rewarding warm glow, as it is called in experimental economics, is it not also in your own interest to help others? Are you not then helping yourself? Being kind to others means being kind to yourself. Likewise, if you feel better and make more money when you're generous and contribute to the well-being and resources of other people, as in the welfare societies that, like my own Denmark, became rich through sharing and equality, then whoever wants to keep everything for himself, with no gift-giving, no tax-paying, and no generosity, is just an amateur egoist. Real egoists share. It's not altruistic to be an altruist, just wise. Helping others is in your own interest. We don't need a concept to explain that behavior. Auguste Comte's concept is therefore ready for retirement, and we can all just help each other without wondering why. The Altruism Hierarchy. Jamil Zaki, Assistant Professor of Psychology, Stanford University. Human beings are the unequivocal world champions of niceness. We act kindly not only toward people who belong to our own social groups or can reciprocate our generosity, but also toward strangers thousands of miles away who will never know we helped them. All around the world, people sacrifice their resources, well-being, and even their lives in the service of others. For behavioral scientists, the great and terrible thing about altruism, behavior that helps others at a cost to the helper, is its inherent contradictions. Pro-social behaviors appear to contradict economic and evolutionary axioms about how humans should behave: selfishly, nasty and brutish, red in tooth and claw, or whichever catchphrase you prefer. After all, how could organisms that sacrifice for others survive? And why would nature endow us with such self-defeating tendencies? In recent decades, researchers have largely solved this problem, offering reasons that perfectly self-oriented organisms might behave altruistically. Solving the altruism paradox becomes trivial when individuals help family members, thus advancing helpers' genes, or others who can reciprocate, increasing helpers' chances of future gains, or others in public, enhancing helpers' reputations. We see these motives at work all around us, in parenting, favors for bosses, opera patrons donating just enough to get their names on the donor plaque in the lobby. More recently, my colleagues and I, as well as other neuroscientists, uncovered another selfish motive for altruism. Helping others simply feels good. It engages brain structures associated with reward and motivation, like those that come online when you see a beautiful face, win money, or eat chocolate. Further, this reward-related brain activity not only accompanies giving, but also predicts people's willingness to give, suggesting a tight link between pleasure and generosity. This doesn't mean that altruism is the psychological equivalent of Ben and Jerry's, but it does provide converging evidence for UC San Diego economist James Andreoni's idea that generosity produces a hedonic, warm glow. One common response I receive when presenting this work has grown increasingly bothersome. Often an audience member will claim that if people experience helping as rewarding, then their actions aren't really altruistic at all. The claim, as I understand it, traces back to the Kantian notion embedded in the cost to the helper part of altruism's definition, that virtuous action is motivated by principle alone, and that benefiting from that action, whether by material gain or psychological pleasure, disqualifies it as virtuous. Often this contention devolves into long, animated, and to my mind useless attempts to find space for true altruism amid an avalanche of ulterior motives. This altruism hierarchy, with a near mystical true altruism residing somewhere in the distance and our sullied attempts at it crowding out real life, is widespread. It also plays a role in matters of judgment. A recent study by George Newman and Dalian Kane of the Yale School of Management demonstrates that people judge people as less moral when they act altruistically and gain in the process than when they gain from clearly non-altruistic behavior. In essence, people view tainted altruism as worse than no altruism at all. The altruism hierarchy should be retired. I believe that people often help others absent the goal of any personal gain. The social psychologist Dan Batson, philosopher Philip Kitcher, and others have done the philosophical and empirical work of distinguishing other-oriented and self-oriented motives for pro-sociality. But I also believe that the reservation of terms such as pure or real for actions bereft of any personal gain is less than useful, for two reasons, both of which connect to the broader idea of self-negation. First, the altruism hierarchy is logically self-negating. Attempts to identify true altruism often boil down to redacting motivation from behavior altogether. The story goes that in order to be pure, helping others must dissociate from personal desire, to look good, feel rewarded, etc. But it's logically fallacious to think of any human behavior as amotivated. De facto, when people engage in actions, it's because they want to. This could represent an overt desire to gain personally, but it could also stem from previous learning. For instance, that helping others in the past has felt good or provided personal gain that translates into an intuitive pro-social preference. Disqualifying self-motivated behavior as altruistic obscures the universality of motivation in producing all behavior, generous or not. Second, the altruism hierarchy is morally self-negating. Critics of impure altruism often seem to chide helpers for acting in human ways, for instance, by doing things that feel good. The ideal, then, seems to entail acting altruistically while not enjoying those actions one bit. To me, this is no ideal at all. It's profound and downright beautiful to think that our core emotional makeup can be tuned toward others, causing us to feel good when we do. Color me selfish. But I'd take that impure altruism over a de-enervated floating ideal any day. Humans are by nature social animals. Adam Waits, psychologist, assistant professor of management and organizations, Kellogg School of Management, Northwestern University. For reinforcing a perilous social-psychological imperialism toward other behavioral sciences, and for suggesting that humans are naturally oriented toward others, the strong interpretation of Aristotle's famous aphorism needs to be retired. Certainly, sociality is a dominant force that shapes thought, behavior, physiology, and neural activity. However, enthusiasm over the social brain, social hormones, and social cognition must be tempered with evidence that being social is far from easy, automatic, or infinite. This is because our social brains, social hormones, and social cognition, on which social processes rely, must first be triggered before they do anything for us. One of the most compelling pieces of evidence for humans' ostensibly automatic social nature comes from Fritz Haider and Marianne Simmel's famous 1944 animation of two triangles and a circle orbiting a rectangle. The animation depicts merely shapes, yet people find it nearly impossible not to construe these objects as human actors and to construct a social drama around their movements. A closer look at the video, and a closer reading of Haider and Simmel's article describing the phenomenon, suggests that the perception of these shapes in social terms is not automatic, but must be evoked by features of the stimuli and situation. These shapes were designed to move in trajectories that specifically mimic social behavior. If the shape's motion is altered or reversed, they fail to elicit the same degree of social responses. Furthermore, participants in the original studies of this animation were prompted to describe the shapes in social terms by the language and instructions the experimenters used. Humans may be ready and willing to view the world through a social lens, but they don't do so automatically. Despite possessing capacities far beyond those of other animals to consider others' minds, to empathize with others' needs, and to transform empathy into care and generosity, we fail to employ these abilities readily, easily, or equally. We engage in acts of loyalty, moral concern, and cooperation primarily toward our inner circles, at the expense of people outside those circles. Our altruism is not unbounded. It is parochial. In support of this phenomenon, the hormone oxytocin, long considered to play a key role in forming social bonds, has been shown to facilitate affiliation toward one's in-group, but can increase defensive aggression toward one's out-group. Other research suggests that this self-sacrificial intra-group love co-evolved with inter-group war, and that societies who most value loyalty tend to be those most likely to endorse violence toward outgroups. Even our arguably most important social capacity, theory of mind, the ability to adopt others' perspectives, can increase competition as much as it increases cooperation, highlighting the emotions and desires of those we like, but also highlighting the selfish and unethical motives of those we dislike. For us to consider the minds of others in the first place requires motivation and the necessary cognitive resources. Because motivation and cognition are finite, so too is our social capacity. Thus, any intervention that tends to increase consideration of others, in terms of empathy, benevolence, and compassion, is limited in its ability to do so. At some point, the well of working memory on which our most valuable social abilities rely will run dry. Because our social capacities are largely non-automatic, in-group focused, and finite, we can retire the strong version of Aristotle's statement. At the same time, the concept of humans as social by nature has lent credibility to numerous significant ideas. That humans need other humans to survive, that humans tend to be perpetually ready for social interaction, and that studying the specifically social features of human functioning is profoundly important. Evidence-based medicine. Gary Klein, psychologist, senior scientist, Macrocognition, LLC, author, Seeing What Others Don't. Any enterprise has its limits and boundary conditions, and science is no exception. When the reach of science moves beyond these boundary conditions, when it demands respect and obedience it hasn't earned, the results can be counterproductive. One example is evidence-based medicine, EBM, which is the scientific idea I think we should retire. The concept behind EBM is certainly admirable, a set of best practices validated by rigorous experiments. EBM seeks to provide healthcare practitioners with treatments they can trust, treatments that have been evaluated by randomized, controlled trials, preferably blinded. EBM seeks to transform medicine into a scientific discipline rather than an art form. What's not to like? We don't want to return to the days of quack fads and unverified anecdotes. But we should trust EBM only if the science behind best practices is infallible and comprehensive. And that's certainly not the case. Medical science is not infallible. Practitioners shouldn't believe a published study just because it meets the criteria of randomized controlled trial design. Too many of these studies cannot be replicated. Sometimes the researcher got lucky, and the experiments that failed to replicate the finding never got published or even submitted to a journal, the so-called publication bias. In rare cases, the researcher has faked the results. Even when the results can be replicated, they shouldn't automatically be believed. Conditions may have been set up in a way that misses the phenomenon of interest, so a negative finding doesn't necessarily rule out an effect. And medical science is not comprehensive. Best practices often take the form of simple rules to follow, but practitioners work in complex situations. EBM relies on controlled studies that vary one thing at a time, rarely more than two or three. Many patients suffer from multiple medical problems, such as type 2 diabetes compounded with asthma. The protocol that works with one problem may be inappropriate for the others. EBM formulates best practices for general populations, but practitioners treat individuals and need to take individual differences into account. A treatment that's generally ineffective might still be useful for a subset of patients. Further, physicians aren't finished once they select a treatment. They often have to adapt it. They need expertise to judge whether a patient is recovering at an appropriate rate. Physicians have to monitor the effectiveness of a treatment plan and then modify or replace it if it isn't working well. A patient's condition may naturally fluctuate, and physicians have to judge the treatment effects on top of this noisy baseline. Sure, scientific investigations have done us all a great service by weeding out ineffective remedies. For example, a recent placebo-controlled study found that arthroscopic surgery provided no greater benefit than sham surgery for patients with osteoarthritic knees. But we're also grateful for all the surgical advances of the past few decades, hip and knee replacements, cataract treatments, that were achieved without randomized controlled trials and placebo conditions. Controlled experiments are therefore unnecessary for progress in new types of treatments, and they're not sufficient for implementing treatments with individual patients who each have unique profiles. Worse, reliance on EBM can impede scientific progress. If hospitals and insurance companies mandate EBM, backed up by the threat of lawsuits when adverse outcomes are accompanied by any departure from best practices, physicians will become reluctant to try alternative treatment strategies that haven't yet been evaluated using randomized controlled trials. Scientific advancement can be stifled if frontline physicians who blend medical expertise with respect for research are prevented from exploration and discouraged from making discoveries. Large randomized controlled trials. Dean Ornish, founder and president, Preventive Medicine Research Institute, clinical professor of medicine, University of California, San Francisco. It's a commonly held but erroneous belief that a larger study is always more definitive than a smaller one, and a randomized controlled trial is the gold standard. However, there's a growing awareness that size doesn't always matter, and that a randomized controlled trial may introduce its own biases. We need more creative experimental designs. In any scientific study, the question is, what is the likelihood that observed differences between the experimental group and the control group are due to the intervention or due to chance? By convention, if the probability is less than 5% that the results are due to chance, then the finding is considered statistically significant, that is, a real finding. A randomized controlled trial, or RCT, is based on the idea that if you randomly assign subjects to an experimental group that receives an intervention or a control group that does not, then any differences, known or unknown, between subjects that might bias the study are as likely to affect one group as the other. While that sounds good in theory, in practice an RCT can often introduce its own set of biases and thus undermine the validity of the findings. For example, an RCT may be designed to determine whether dietary changes may prevent heart disease and cancer. Investigators identify patients who meet certain selection criteria. For example, they have several risk factors for heart disease or cancer. The study is described to prospective participants in great detail, and they are asked, if you are randomly assigned to the experimental group, would you be willing to change your lifestyle? In order to be eligible for the study, the patient needs to answer yes. However, if that patient is subsequently randomly assigned to the control group, she may begin to make lifestyle changes on her own, since she has already been told in detail what those lifestyle changes are. If the study is of a new drug available only to the experimental group, then this is less of an issue. But in a study of behavioral interventions, patients randomly assigned to the control group are likely to make at least some of those behavioral changes because they believe the changes are worth making or they wouldn't be of interest to the investigators. Or they may be disappointed at having been assigned to the control group and so more likely to drop out of the study, creating selection bias. In a large-scale RCT, moreover, it's often hard to provide all the subjects in the experimental group with enough support and resources to make the prescribed lifestyle changes. Thus, adherence to these changes is often less rigorous than investigators predicted based on earlier pilot studies with smaller groups of patients. The net effect of all this is to A. reduce the likelihood that the experimental group will make the desired lifestyle changes, and B. increase the likelihood that the control group will make similar lifestyle changes. This narrows the differences between the two groups and produces a less statistically significant outcome. Thus, the conclusion that the behavioral changes had little or no effect may be misleading. This is known as a type 2 error, meaning that there was a real difference, but that these design issues obscured its detection. That's just what happened in the Women's Health Initiative study of dietary modification, which followed nearly 50,000 middle-aged or older women for more than 8 years. The women in the experimental group were asked to eat less fat and more fruits, vegetables, and whole grains daily to see if this could help prevent heart disease and cancer. The women in the control group were not asked to change their diets. However, the experimental group participants failed to reduce their dietary fat as recommended. Over 29% of their diet was comprised of fat, not the study's goal of less than 20%. Also, they didn't substantially increase their consumption of fruits and vegetables. In contrast, the control group reduced its consumption of fat almost as much and increased its consumption of fruits and vegetables, diluting the between-group differences to the point where they weren't statistically significant. The investigators reported that these dietary changes did not protect against heart disease or cancer, but the hypothesis was not really tested. Paradoxically, a small study may be more likely to show significant differences between groups than a large one. The Women's Health Initiative study cost almost $1 billion, yet did not adequately test the hypotheses. A smaller study provides more resources per patient at lower cost to enhance adherence. Also, the idea in RCTs that you're changing only one independent variable, the intervention, and measuring one dependent variable, the result, is often a myth. Let's say you're investigating the effects of exercise on preventing cancer. You devise a study wherein you randomly assign one group to exercise and the other group to no exercise. On paper, it appears that you're working with just one independent variable. In practice, however, when you place people on an exercise program, you're not just getting them to exercise, you're also affecting other factors that may confound the interpretation of your results. For example, people often exercise with other people, and there's increasing evidence that enhanced social support significantly reduces the risk of most chronic diseases. You're also endowing your study participants with a sense of meaning and purpose, and this also produces therapeutic benefits. And when people exercise, they often begin to eat healthier foods. We need new, more thoughtful experimental designs and systems approaches that take into account these issues. And new genomic insights will help us to better understand individual responses to treatment, instead of hoping that this variability will be averaged out by the random assignment of patients. Multiple regression as a means of discovering causality. Richard Nisbet, Professor of Psychology, University of Michigan. Author, Intelligence and How to Get It. Did you know that consuming large amounts of olive oil can reduce your mortality risk by 41%? Did you know that if you have cataracts and get them operated on, your mortality risk is lowered by 40% over the next 15 years compared to people with cataracts who don't get them operated on? Did you know that deafness causes dementia? Those claims and scores like them appear every day in the media. They're usually based on studies employing multiple regression analysis, MRA. In MRA, a number of independent variables are correlated simultaneously with some dependent variable. The goal is typically to show that variable A influences variable B net of the effects of all the other variables. To put that a little differently, the goal is to show that at every level of variables C, D, and E, an association between A and B is found. For example, drinking wine is correlated with low incidence of cardiovascular disease, controlling for, net of, the contributions to cardiovascular disease of social class, excess weight, age, etc., etc. Epidemiologists, medical researchers, sociologists, psychologists, and economists are particularly likely to use this technique, although it can be used in almost any scientific field. The claims, always at least implicit, often explicit, that MRA can reveal causality, are mistaken. We know that the target independent variable, consumption of olive oil, for example, brings along its correlations with many other variables, measured in some inevitably imperfect way or not at all. And the level on each of these variables is self-selected. Any one of them could be driving the effects on the dependent variable. Would you think the number of children in a classroom matters for how well school children learn? It seems reasonable that it would. But a number of MRA studies tell us that net of average income of families in the school district, size of the school, IQ test performance, city size, geographic location, etc., average class size is uncorrelated with student performance. The implication? We now know we needn't waste money on decreasing the size of classes. But researchers have assigned kindergartners through third graders, by the flip of a coin, to either small classes, 13 to 17 per class, or larger classes, 22 to 25. The smaller classes showed more improvement in standardized test performance. The effect on minority children was greater than the effect on white children. This is not merely another study on the effects of class size. It replaces all the multiple regression studies on class size. This is the case because the experimenter selects the level on the target-independent variable. This means that the experimental classrooms have equally good teachers on average, equally able students, equal social class of students, etc. Thus, the only thing that differs between experimental and control classrooms is the independent variable of interest, namely class size. MRA studies that attempt to control for other factors, such as social class, age, prior state of health, and so on, can't get around the self-selection problem. The sorts of people who get treatment differ from those who don't get it in goodness knows how many ways. Consider social class. If an investigator wishes to see whether social class is associated with some outcome, anything correlated with social class might be producing or suppressing the effects of class per se. We can be fairly sure that the people consuming all that olive oil are richer, better educated, more knowledgeable about health, and more concerned about health, with spouses also more concerned about their health, and so on. They're less likely to smoke or to drink to excess, and they probably live in less toxic environments than people who use corn oil. They're also more likely to be of Italian descent. Italians are relatively long-lived than African descent. Blacks have generally high mortality rates. All these variables are candidates for being the true cause of the association between social class and mortality rather than the consumption of olive oil per se. Even when there's an attempt to control for all possible variables, they're not necessarily well measured, which means that their contribution to the target-dependent variable will be underestimated. For example, there's no unique correct way to measure social class. Education level, income, wealth, and occupational level are all pieces of the pie, and there's no canonical way to weight them to come up with the same social class value that God has in mind. A New York Times op-ed writer, a PhD at Harvard, recently expressed the opinion that MRA studies are superior to experiments because MRA studies based on big data can have many more subjects. The error here is the assumption that having a relatively small number of subjects is likely to mislead. Larger n is always better than smaller n because we're more likely to detect even small effects. But our confidence in studies is based not on the number of cases, but on whether we have unbiased estimates of effects and the effects are statistically significant. In fact, if you have a statistically significant effect with a relatively small number of subjects, this means, other things being equal, that your effect is bigger than if it had required a larger number of subjects to reach the same level of significance. Big data will be useful for all kinds of purposes, including generating MRA findings that suggest randomized design experiments that can provide definitive evidence about whether an apparent effect is real. A lovely example of this kind of sequence results from the 2011 finding in MRA research by Guglielmo Becutti and Silvana Pannaina that low levels of sleep are associated with obesity. That finding, taken by itself, is next to meaningless. Bad health outcomes are almost all correlated with each other. Overweight people have worse cardiovascular health, worse psychological health, use more drugs, get less exercise, and so on. But following the MRA research, experimenters must have done the requisite experiments. They deprived people of sleep and found that they did, in fact, gain weight. Not only that, but researchers found hormonal and endocrine consequences of sleep disturbances that mediated the weight gain. Multiple regression, like all statistical techniques based on correlation, has a severe limitation. Correlation doesn't prove causation, and no amount of measuring of control variables can untangle the web of causality. What nature hath joined together, multiple regression cannot put asunder.
Mouse models. Azra Raza, professor of medicine, director, MDS Center, Columbia University. An obvious truth, which is either being ignored or going unaddressed in cancer research, is that mouse models don't mimic human disease well and are essentially worthless for drug development. We cured acute leukemia in mice in 1977 with drugs we're still using in exactly the same dosage and duration in humans, with dreadful results. Imagine the artificiality of taking human tumor cells, growing them in lab dishes, then transferring them to mice whose immune systems have been compromised so they can't reject the implanted tumors, and then exposing these xenografts to drugs whose killing efficiency and toxicity profiles will then be applied to treat human cancers. The inherent pitfalls of such a synthesized, unnatural model system have also plagued other disciplines. A recent scientific paper showed that nearly 150 drugs tested at the cost of billions of dollars in human trials of sepsis failed because the drugs had been developed using mice. Unfortunately, what looked like sepsis in mice turned out to be very different from what sepsis is in humans. Coverage of this study by Gina Colata in the New York Times brought heated response from within the biomedical research community. There is no basis for leveraging a niche piece of research to imply that mice are useless models for all human diseases. The key is to construct the appropriate mouse models and design the experimental conditions that mirror the human situation. The problem is that there are no appropriate mouse models that can mirror the human situation. So why is the cancer research community still dominated by the dysfunctional tradition of employing mouse models to test hypotheses for the development of new drugs? Robert Weinberg of the Whitehead Institute at MIT has provided the best answer. In an interview, he offered two reasons. First, there's no model with which to replace it. And second, the Food and Drug Administration has created inertia because it continues to recognize these models as the gold standard for predicting the utility of drugs. There's a third reason, related to the frailties of human nature. Too many eminent laboratories and illustrious researchers have devoted too much of their time to studying malignant diseases in mouse models, and they're the ones reviewing one another's grants and deciding where the National Institutes of Health money gets spent. They're not prepared to concede that mouse models are basically valueless for most cancer therapeutics. One of the main reasons we stick to this archaic ethos is to obtain funding. Here's one example. I decided to study a bone marrow malignant disease called myelodysplastic syndromes, MDS, which frequently evolves into acute leukemia back in the early 1980s. One early decision I made was to concentrate my research on freshly obtained human cells and not rely on mice or petri dishes alone. In the last three decades, I have collected over 50,000 bone marrow biopsies, normal control buccal smear cells, and blood, serum, and plasma samples in a well-annotated tissue repository backed by a computerized bank of clinical, pathologic, and morphologic data. Using these samples, we have identified novel genes involved in causing certain types of MDS, as well as sets of genes related to survival, natural history of the disease, and response to therapy. But when I used bone marrow cells from treated MDS patients to develop a genomic expression profile that was startlingly predictive of response and applied for an NIH grant to validate the signature, the main criticism was that before confirming it through a prospective trial in humans, I should first reproduce it in mice. It's time to let go of the mouse models, at least as surrogates for bringing drugs to the bedside. Remember what Mark Twain said? What gets us into trouble is not what we don't know. It's what we know for sure that just ain't so.
The Somatic Mutation Theory of Cancer. Paul Davies, theoretical physicist, cosmologist, astrobiologist. Director, Beyond. Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science, Arizona State University. Author, The Eerie Silence, Renewing Our Search for Alien Intelligence. Cancer is one of the most intensively studied phenomena in biology, yet mortality rates from the disease are little changed in decades. Perhaps that's because we're thinking about the problem in the wrong way. A major impediment to progress is the deep entrenchment of a 50-year-old paradigm, the so-called somatic mutation theory. It goes like this. A somatic cell serially accumulates genetic damage, eventually reaching a point at which it decouples from the organism's regulatory systems and embarks on its own agenda. Cancer cells acquire a range of distinctive hallmarks: unfettered proliferation, evasion of apoptosis, programmed cell death, motility and migratory powers, genomic rearrangements, epigenetic alterations, and changes in the mode of metabolism, chromatin architecture, and elasticity, to mention a few, that collectively confer remarkable robustness and survivability. In the standard picture, cancer, with all these attendant hallmarks, is considered to be reinvented de novo in each host organism, the result of a dream run of lucky genetic accidents. The gain of all these amazing fitness functions, co-located in the same neoplasm, population of new cells, over a period of as little as months or even weeks, is attributed to a sort of ultra-fast-paced Darwinian evolution going on in the body of the host organism. Unfortunately, this theory, despite its simplicity and popular appeal, has only one successful prediction: that the administration of chemotherapeutic drugs is likely to fail on account of the neoplasm's ability to rapidly evolve a resistant subpopulation. Armed with the somatic mutation paradigm, the research community has become fixated on the promise of sequencing technology, which enables genetic and epigenetic changes in cells to be measured on a vast scale. If cancer is caused by mutations, so the reasoning goes, then maybe subtle patterns can be teased out of petabytes of bewildering cancer sequencing data. If so, then the answer to cancer, perhaps even that elusive general-purpose cure, might be found by identifying common defects amid all that stunningly complex malfunctioning genetic machinery. Never has science offered a clearer example of a preoccupation with trees at the expense of the forest. Stand back and take a hard, skeptical look at that forest. Cancer is widespread among multicellular organisms, afflicting mammals, birds, fish, and reptiles. It clearly has deep evolutionary roots, probably stretching back over a billion years to the dawn of multicellularity. Indeed, it represents a breakdown of multicelled cooperation. Unchecked, cancer follows a predictable pattern of progression, usually spreading around the body and colonizing remote organs. It seems to be executing an efficient, preloaded genetic and epigenetic program. Like a genie in a glass bottle, once it gets out, it has a well-defined agenda. Many things can shatter the bottle, but the real culprit is the genie. The cancer research community, unfortunately, is preoccupied with seeking mostly irrelevant patterns amid the random shards of glass while ignoring the genie? Why are our cells harboring such dangerous genies? The answer has been known for a long time, but is mostly shrugged aside. The same genes active in cancer are also active in early embryogenesis, even in gametogenesis, and to some extent in wound healing and tissue regeneration. These ancient genes are deeply embedded and well protected in our genomes. They run the core functionality of cells. Top of the functionality list is the ability to proliferate, the most fundamental modality of living organisms, with nearly 4 billion years of evolutionary refinement behind it. Cancer seems to be the default state of cells that are stressed or insulted in some way, such as by aging tissue architecture or carcinogenic chemicals, with tumors representing a reversion to an ancestral phenotype. In biology, few things are black or white. The somatic mutation paradigm is undeniably of some relevance to cancer, and sequencing data is certainly not useless. Indeed, it could prove a gold mine if only the research community comes to interpret that data in the right way. But the narrow focus of current cancer research is a serious obstacle to progress. Cancer will be understood properly only by positioning it within the great sweep of evolutionary history. The linear no threshold, LNT, radiation dose hypothesis. Stuart Brand, founder Whole Earth Catalog, co-founder The Well, The Long Now Foundation, author Whole Earth Discipline. In his 1976 book, A Scientist at the White House, George Kistyakovsky, President Eisenhower's science advisor, told what he wrote in his diary in 1960 on being exposed to the idea by the Federal Radiation Council. "It is a rather appalling document which takes 140 pages to state the simple fact that since we know virtually nothing about the dangers of low-intensity radiation, we might as well agree that the average population dose from man-made radiation should be no greater than that which the population already receives from natural causes, and that any individual in that population shouldn't be exposed to more than 3 times that amount, the latter figure being, of course, totally arbitrary." Later in the book, Kistyakovsky, who was a nuclear expert and veteran of the Manhattan Project, wrote, "A linear relation between dose and effect, I still believe, is entirely unnecessary for the definition of the current radiation guidelines, since they are pulled out of thin air without any knowledge on which to base them. 63 years of research on radiation effects have gone by, and Kistyakovsky's critique still holds. The linear no-threshold, LNT, radiation dose hypothesis, which surreally influences every regulation and public fear about nuclear power, is based on no knowledge whatever. At stake are the hundreds of billions spent on meaningless levels of safety around nuclear power plants and waste storage, the projected costs of next-generation nuclear plant designs to reduce greenhouse gases worldwide, and the extremely harmful episodes of public panic that accompany rare radiation release events like Fukushima and Chernobyl. No birth defects were caused by Chernobyl, but fear of them led to 100,000 panic abortions in the Soviet Union and Europe. What people remember about Fukushima is that nuclear opponents predicted that hundreds or thousands would die or become ill from the radiation. In fact, nobody died, nobody became ill, and nobody is expected to." The linear part of the LNT is true and well documented. Based on long-term studies of nuclear industry workers and survivors of the atomic bombing of Japan, the incidence of eventual cancer increases with increasing exposure to radiation at levels above 100 millisieverts a year. The effect is linear. Below 100 millisieverts a year, however, no increased cancer incidence has been detected, either because it doesn't exist or because the numbers are so low that any signal gets lost in the epidemiological noise. We all die. Nearly half of us die of cancer, 38% of females, 45% of males. If the no threshold part of the LNT is taken seriously, and an exposed population experiences as much as a 0.5% increase in cancer risk, it simply cannot be detected. The LNT operates on the unprovable assumption that the cancer deaths exist even if the increase is too small to detect, and that therefore no level of radiation is safe, and every extra millisievert is a public health hazard. Some evidence against the no-threshold hypothesis draws on studies of background radiation. In the U.S., we're all exposed to 6.2 millisieverts a year on average, but it varies regionally. New England has lower background radiation, Colorado is much higher, yet cancer rates in New England are higher than in Colorado, an inverse effect. Some places in the world, such as Ramsar, Iran, have a tenfold higher background radiation, but no higher cancer rates have been discovered there. These results suggest that there is indeed a threshold below which radiation is not harmful. Furthermore, recent research at the cell level shows a number of mechanisms for repair of damaged DNA and ejection of damaged cells up to significant radiation levels. This isn't surprising, given that life evolved amid high radiation and other threats to DNA. The DNA repair mechanisms that have existed in yeast for 800 million years are also present in humans. The actual threat of low-dose radiation to humans is so low that the LNT hypothesis can neither be proved true nor proved false, yet it continues to dominate and misguide policies concerning radiation exposure, making them grotesquely conservative and expensive. Once the LNT is explicitly discarded, we can move on to regulations that reflect only discernible, measurable medical effects and respond mainly to the much larger considerations of whole system benefits and harms. The most crucial decisions about nuclear power are at the category level of world urban prosperity and climate change, not imaginary cancers per millisievert. Universal Grammar. Benjamin K. Bergen, Associate Professor of Cognitive Science, University of California, San Diego, author, Louder Than Words. The world's languages differ to the point of inscrutability. Knowing the English word duck doesn't help you guess the French canard or Japanese ahiru. But there are commonalities hidden beneath the superficial differences. For instance, human languages tend to have parts of speech, like nouns and verbs. They tend to have ways to embed propositions in other ones. John knows that Mary thinks that Paul embeds propositions in other ones, and so on. But why? An influential and appealing explanation is known as universal grammar. Core commonalities across languages exist because they're part of our genetic endowment. On this view, humans are born with a predisposition to develop languages with specific properties. Infants expect to learn a language that has nouns and verbs, that has sentences with embedded propositions, and so on. This idea could explain not only why languages are similar, but also what it is to be uniquely human, and, indeed, how children acquire their native language. It may also seem intuitively plausible, especially to people who speak several languages. If English and Spanish and French have nouns and verbs, why wouldn't every language? To date, universal grammar remains one of the most visible products of the field of linguistics. The one minimally counterintuitive bit that former students often retain from an introductory linguistics class. But evidence has not been kind to universal grammar. Over the years, field linguists, they're like field biologists with really good microphones, have reported that languages are much more diverse than originally thought. Not all languages have nouns and verbs. Nor do all languages let you embed propositions in others. And so it is gone for basically every proposed universal linguistic feature. The empirical foundation has crumbled out from under universal grammar. We thought there might be universals that all languages share, and we sought to explain them on the basis of innate biases. But as the purportedly universal features have revealed themselves to be nothing of the sort, the need to explain them in categorical terms has evaporated. As a result, what can plausibly make up the content of universal grammar has become progressively modest over time. At present, there's evidence that nothing but perhaps the most general computational principles are part of our innate language-specific human endowment. So it's time to retire universal grammar. It had a good run, but there's nothing much it can bring us now in terms of what we want to know about human language. It can't reveal much about how language develops in children, how they learn to articulate sounds, to infer the meanings of words, to put words together into sentences, to infer emotions and mental states from what people say, and so on. And the same is true for questions about how humans have evolved or how we differ from other animals. There are ways in which humans are unique in the animal kingdom, and a science of language ought to be trying to understand these. But again, universal grammar, gutted by evidence as it has been, will not help much. Of course, it remains important and interesting to ask what commonalities, superficial and substantial, tie together the world's languages. There may be hints there about how human language evolved and how it develops. But to ignore its diversity is to set aside its most informative dimension. Science of language should deal only with competence. N.J. Enfield, Senior Staff Scientist, Language and Cognition Group, Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics, Nijmegen, the Netherlands. Author, Relationship Thinking. Suppose that a scientist wants to study a striking animal behavior, say the courtship display of the stickleback fish or the cooperative agriculture of leafcutter ants. She will, of course, ultimately want to know the underlying mechanisms of these behaviors. How do they work? How did they evolve? What can we learn from them? But no student of animal behavior would dream of asking those questions without first systematically discovering the facts, beginning with extensive field observation in the wild, then moving to experiments and modeling in the lab. Why, then, have linguists emphatically denied any value in directly observing linguistic behavior? The culprit is a bad idea. That a science of language should be concerned only with competence, the mental capacity for producing sentences, and never with performance, what happens when we actually talk. Here is its decidedly dualist reasoning. When the idealized language patterns tucked away in the mind get externalized in communication, they're filtered and shaped by contingencies, such as motor constraints, attention and memory limitations, errors of execution, local conventions, and more. As a result, it is argued, performance bears little useful relation to the predefined object of study, competence. Students of linguistics have been taught not to waste their time with the worldly facts of performance. This idea amounts to an unaccountably narrow view of what language is. It has diverted linguists' attention from many substantial questions, each with deep implications. Just a few examples. Without looking at performance, we wouldn't see the systematic and ingenious ways in which people handle the constant speech errors, hesitations, and misfires of conversation, along with the social delicacies of navigating these bouts of turbulence. Nor would we see the emerging breakthroughs from statistical research on newly available large language corpora, with results suggesting that we can infer competence by looking at performance. Nor, finally, would linguistics have a causal account of how languages evolve historically. In the cycle of language transmission going from public, someone speaks, to private, someone's mental state is affected, and back to public, that person speaks, and so on indefinitely, both the private domain of competence and the public domain of performance are equally indispensable. Influential traditions in the discipline of linguistics have embraced an idea that makes little sense, given the fact that language is, after all, just another striking animal behavior. The science of language should begin with fieldwork observation, for performance is ultimately our only evidence for competence. Perhaps the most unfortunate outcome of this idea is that generations of linguists who have eschewed the study of performance now have nothing to say about the essentially social function of language, nor about those aspects of social agency, cooperation, and social accountability that universally define our species' unique communicative capacity. Languages condition worldviews. John McWhirter, Professor of Linguistics, Columbia University. Author, The Language Hoax. Since the 1930s, when Benjamin Lee Whorf was mesmerizing audiences with the idea that the Hopi people's language channeled them into a cyclical sense of time, the media and university classrooms have often been abuzz with the idea that the way your language works gives you a particular worldview. You want this to be true, but it isn't, at least in a way that anyone outside of a psychology laboratory or academic journal would be interested in. It's high time thinking people let go of the idea, ever heralded as a possibility but never demonstrated, that different languages represent different ways of experiencing life. Different cultures represent different ways of experiencing life, to be sure. And part of a culture is having words and expressions to express it, to be sure. Cell phone. Inshallah. Feng shui. But this isn't what Whorfianism, as it's often called, is onto. The idea is that quiet things in a language's structural architecture, how its grammar works, how its vocabulary happens to cut up space, channel how the speaker experiences life. And in fact, psychologists have indeed shown that such things do influence thought, in tiny ways elicitable via fascinatingly peculiar experiments. So, Russian has different words for dark blue and light blue, and no one word that just means blue, and it's been shown that Russians are indeed 124 milliseconds faster at matching grades of dark blue to other ones and grades of light blue to other ones. It's also been shown that people whose languages divide nouns into masculine and feminine categories are more likely, if asked, to imagine those things, if they were cartoon characters, talking in the appropriately sexed voice, or to associate them with gendered traits. This kind of thing is neat, but the question is whether the quiet background flutterings of awareness they document can be treated as a worldview. The temptation is endless to suppose that it does. Plus, we're always reminded that no one has said that language prevents a speaker from thinking such and such, but rather that language makes it likelier that the speaker will think such and such. But we still run up against the fact that languages tell us what we don't want to hear as much as they tell us what's cool, such as Russian blues and tables talking like ladies. Example. In Mandarin Chinese, the same sentence can mean, "If you see my sister, you know she's pregnant." Or, "If you saw my sister, you'd know she's pregnant." Or, "If you had seen my sister, you'd have known she was pregnant." That is, Chinese leaves hypotheticality to context much more than English does. In the early 80s, psychologist Alfred Bloom, following the Whorfian line, did an experiment suggesting that Chinese makes its speakers somewhat less adept than English speakers at processing hypothetical scenarios. Whoops. Nobody wanted to hear that. There was a long train of rebuttals, ending in an exhausted draw. But you could do all kinds of experiments that would lead to the same kind of place. Lots of languages in New Guinea have only one word for eating, drinking, and smoking. Does that make them slightly less sensitive to the culinary than other people? Swedish doesn't have a word for wipe. You have to erase, take off, and so on. But who's ready to tell the Swedes they don't wipe? In cases like this, our natural inclination is to say that such things are just accidents, and whatever wisp of thought difference as experimenter could elicit based on them has hardly anything to do with what the language's speakers are like or what their worldview is. But then we have to admit the same thing about the wisps that happen to tickle our fancies. What creates a worldview is culture. That is, a worldview. And no, it won't work to say that culture and language create a worldview together holistically. Remember, that would mean that Chinese speakers are holistically a little dim when it comes to thinking beyond reality. Who wants to go there? Especially when even starting to go there, decade after decade, has led us down blind alleys. Hopi, it turns out, has plenty of markers of good old-fashioned European-style time. UCLA economist Keith Chen's recent idea that not having a future tense makes a language's speaker more thrifty. Pause to wrap your head around that. It's not having a future that makes you save money. Has intrigued the media for years now. But if four Slavic languages, Russian, Polish, Czech, and Slovak, have no future tense, and yet savings rates in those countries are vastly different, then the whole idea is out the window. The idea that language is a lens on life should be treated as what it is, something that pans out in terms of quiet results in intense psychological studies, but has nothing to do with any humanistic perspective on what it means to be a human being. An awkward aspect of this is that people engaged in trying to document or save the hundreds of languages worldwide threatened with extinction tend to say that the languages must survive because they represent ways of looking at the world. But if they don't, we have to formulate new justifications for those rescue efforts. One hopes that linguists and anthropologists can embrace saving languages simply because they are, in so many ways, magnificent in their own right. What it comes down to is this. Let's ask how English makes a worldview. Our answer requires that the worldview be shared by Betty White, William McKinley, Amy Winehouse, Jerry Seinfeld, Kanye West, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Gary Coleman, Virginia Woolf, and Bono. Let's face it, what worldview would that be? Sure, a lab test could likely tease out some infinitesimal squeak of a perceptive predilection shared by all those people, but we wouldn't even begin to think of it as a way of perceiving the world or reflecting a culture. Or if anyone does, then we're on to an entirely new academic paradigm indeed. The Standard Approach to Meaning. Dan Sperber, Social and Cognitive Scientist, Research Professor Emeritus, Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique, Director, International Cognition and Culture Institute, co-author with Deirdre Wilson, Meaning and Relevance. What is meaning? There are dozens of theories. I suspect, however, that little would be lost if most of them were retired and the others quarantined until we've had a serious conversation as to why we need a theory of meaning in the first place. I'm nominating for retirement just the standard approach to meaning found in the study of language and communication. There, meaning is used to talk about 1. What linguistic items, such as words and sentences, mean, and 2. What speakers mean. Linguistic meanings and speakers' meanings are quite different things. To know a word is to know what its meaning or meanings, if it's ambiguous, are. You acquire this knowledge when you learn to speak a language. You also acquire the ability to construct the meaning of a sentence on the basis of the syntax. The meanings of words and the contribution of the syntax to the meaning of sentences are relatively stable linguistic properties that vary over historical time and across dialects. A speaker's meaning, on the other hand, is a component of an individual intention to modify the beliefs or attitudes of other people through communication. What justifies, or so it seems, using the same word, meaning, for these two quite different kinds of phenomena, a linguistic, community-wide stable feature of a language versus an aspect of a social interaction, is a simple and powerful dogma that purports to explain how a speaker manages to convey her meaning to her audience. She does so, we're told, by producing a sentence, the linguistic meaning of which matches her speaker's meaning. The job of the addressee, then, is just to decode. Alas, this simple and powerful account of how we use linguistic meanings to convey our speaker's meanings is not true. This much is obvious to all students of language. The issue is, how far is it from the truth? Take an ordinary sentence. Say, she went. Your competence as an English speaker provides you with all the knowledge of that sentence's meaning you need in order to make use of it, either in speaking or in comprehension. This, however, does not come near to telling you what a speaker who utters this sentence on a given occasion might mean. She might mean that Susan Jones had gone home, that the cat had one day left the house and never returned, or that the RMS Queen Mary II had just left the harbor. She might mean that the neighbor carried out her threat to go to the police, or, ironically, that her interlocutor was a fool to imagine that their neighbor would carry out that threat. She might mean, metaphorically, that Nancy Smith had at some point wholly ceased paying attention, and so forth. None of these meanings is fully encoded by the sentence. Some aren't even partially encoded. That much is true not just of "she went," but also of the vast majority of English sentences, arguably all of them. Linguists and philosophers are aware of this general mismatch between linguistic and speaker's meaning, but most of them treat it as if it were a complication of limited relevance that could be idealized away or left to be investigated by pragmatics, a marginal subfield of linguistics. The dogma, then, comes with an annotation. The basic coding-decoding mechanism that makes communication possible is quite cumbersome. Using it involves being wholly explicit. Luckily, there's a shortcut. You can avoid the verbosity of full explicitness and rely on your audience to infer, rather than decode, at least part of your meaning, or all of it if you use, for instance, a novel metaphor. There are two problems with this dogma. The first is that the alleged basic mechanism is never used. You never fully encode your meaning. Often you don't encode it at all. The second problem is that if we can easily infer a speaker's meaning from an utterance that doesn't encode it, then why, in the first place, do we need the alleged basic encoding-decoding mechanism that's so unwieldy? Imagine a tribe where people who want to go from their valley to the sea always follow a well-trodden path across a low mountain pass. According to the tribe sages, however, this path is just a shortcut, and the real way, without which there couldn't even have been a shortcut, is a majestic road that goes straight up to the top of the mountain and then straight down to the sea. Nobody has ever seen that road, let alone traveled it, but it has been so much talked about that everybody can visualize it and marvel at the sage's wisdom. Linguistics and philosophy are the home of many such sages. Most of the time, semanticists start from the dogma I have just criticized. They provide elaborate, often formal analyses of linguistic meanings that match the contents of our conscious thoughts. Are linguistic meanings really like this? Only a minority of researchers is exploring the idea that they might be a very different kind of mental object. Unlike beliefs and intentions, linguistic meanings may be just as inaccessible to untutored consciousness as are syntactic properties. They must, on the other hand, be the right kind of objects to serve as input to the unconscious inferences that achieve comprehension. Pragmaticists and psycholinguists should, for their part, acknowledge that the meanings conveyed by our utterances may be not at all like individual sentences written in our minds in the language of thought, but rather like partly clear, partly vague, reverberating changes in our cognitive environment. The old dogma that linguistic meanings and speakers' meanings match denies or discounts a blatant gap. This gap is filled by intense cognitive activity of a specifically human kind. Let's retire the dogma and better explore the gap.